what was happening was what I often call the first class lounge culture, where all these homes, whether they were in, you know, the modern rich homes, all began to look like big, very comfortable lounges. And there was nothing unique. You're seeing that in the Indian art market. There's a lot of demand for quality contemporary art. And I think now that's transcending down to craft and design, that there are, you know, very good home-born designers who, in fact, the irony is that they're selling really well internationally. So, it's when the local demands, you know, now is kind of moving towards appreciating them. So that's encouraging.
Vikram Goel is a design pioneer in contemporizing traditional Indian motifs. He's the founder of Via Home, a Delhi-based design and production studio that offers a range of luxury handcrafted products. Committed to the preservation of artisan practices and the country's cultural heritage, he employed craft methods that are centuries old, once patronized by royal families. Much like his products, his interior design endeavors are hailed as inhabitable works of art. Hi Vikram, thank you so much for joining us on the Design Pataki podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you about contemporizing Indian craft forms today, and I'm going to get right to it.
Thank you for having me on.
So my first question, Vikram, is going to be, and I know you've been asked this many times, but you went from engineering to craft and design. What inspired you to build a practice around reviving and modernizing Indian craft forms?
I've always been interested in India and its indigenous traditions. And when I returned to India, having spent a decade in America, I returned in the year 2000, and one of the first things I did was to set up, co-found Kama Ayurveda with a view of taking the goodness of Ayurveda, an ancient Indian practice, to the outside world. And 2 years later, I set up Via with my sister, again with a view to focus on traditional artisanal skills. And actually, we wanted to develop a modern design language, a modern Indian design language, where we would work with local materials, local artisans, and drawn local inspirations, give it a modern interpretation. So that's what we wanted to do, was to get this modern Indian design language.
And tell me about your first few pieces. How did that come about? What were the first few pieces of craft that interested you? What drew you to that?
So one of the first, we looked at inspirations from local architecture and local paint forms. So I looked at the Pichwai example, and we did things, with lotuses, with cows, architectural forms are used at finials, you know, the spires you see on top of mosques and temples, and made giant sculptures out of them. We used the lotus people couldn't get enough of the lotus. So we had lotus tables, lotus handles, sculptures. I mean, there were lotuses everywhere. We kind of exploded the diya and had these giant 3 or 4 foot diameter diyas. So really kind of contemporizing traditional Indian elements, both from Indian architecture, art, and culture.
And, you know, I've noticed that you work a lot with brass. So what drew you to that material? And, you know, is there any new material that you've been exploring or playing with recently?
You know, we wanted to work with the traditional material, and brass was fit the bill. It was used in everyday cooking and ritual vessels, and also as a decoration of temples and palaces. Plus, brass is a very versatile material. You know, you could use it in sheet form, you could use it in cast form. And also what really helped us was there was also already an existing, body of artisans who'd been working on this kind of craft. So it was just a question of putting the studio together and working with them over time and honing all these skills. I should mention that, you know, these skills are not passed on from learnt in school, but they're passed on from generation to generation. And they actually incorporate material science, design, and architecture, which are inherent to centuries of Indian sculpture. So it was really finding, we found this with brass as a traditional material. And what excited me about it was the, you know, that it was malleable, it was dexterous, unlike, for example, say, stone, where, I enjoyed working with stone. We did work with it for a bit, but I just found brass much more versatile in making small objects, very, very large objects, And over the years, our kind of forms moved on from, you know, started with 1 foot diameter objects to now something extending 40 feet in length. So brass just was the perfect medium for that. We've also incorporated the use of pietra diore, the inlay of semi-precious materials. This was traditionally done, for example, in the Taj Mahal, stone on stone. We've just taken it and using it, you know, using it in brass. So we're incorporating the inlay of, say, malachite or lapis in brass. So that's a new material we worked with to kind of, you know, add a different dimension to our work.
And, you know, what were some of the challenges you faced with brass? Because brass also is an expensive material. And, you know, back then, probably when you started, it wasn't used as much in decor as well.
I actually, you know, one of the things was, was that brass changes color, like the silver, which I like because it just lends itself to the more natural aspect of the material. But so getting, and it was easier working with clients abroad because they understood this, you know, bronze and brass change color. And in India, it was more of a challenge just setting expectations. But I think people now have begun to appreciate that, you know, it is a natural material in the sense it's a traditional material. And, you know, along with, say, silk changes, you know, texture. So this changes texture as time goes on.
But that kind of leads me to my next question is, how is it, because you work a lot with the international market as well. So how do you feel the international market is different from your Indian consumer base?
You know, when we first started, we did all this very modern Indian stuff. And the more, then we were represented internationally by an Italian soft furnishing company who represented us in Italy and the UK. And through him, through this company, we actually got to work with, you know, some of the leading international designers. And over the years, we developed a vocabulary which was less Indian. So it was Indian in material, i.e. brass, and Indian in workmanship, but it was very international in its design. And the design took on very organic forms and, you know, so therefore we made it to leading international galleries such as Todd Merrill, you know, where we are shown in New York, because we were able to move from the kind of Indian iconography which you see a lot of in India. Because of our interaction with the international designers, you know, we just had to change our whole design language.
But do you feel that the Indian consumer base has adapted that international language, or do they, you feel, demand a certain different vocabulary?
I would split the Indian market into two. There's one set of customers who want the Indian elements, particularly for, you know, puja rooms and entries and things. So, and we have a whole design language suited towards their needs. Then we also have a lot of India-based designers who are very exposed to the West and Western forms. And so they ask for our products which are more or less Indian in nature. So it's kind of split both ways.
Got it. And in terms of motifs or, you know, Indian forms, what do you feel has been, you know, you started with a lot of lotus forms, or like you mentioned, what do you feel is currently something which everyone's doing or something you're particularly in love with and putting
out
there?
It's really interesting. When I first started, we started working, when I moved back from New York, I didn't want to touch gold. And, you know, it was all about silvers and grays. And now I find that, at least now, where, you know, especially now post-COVID, where everyone's emerging out of this kind of, you want to be in a happy state. There's only demand for gold and glamorous. Not probably the shiny gold we may want it here, but certainly they want that patina as opposed to, you know, dark grays and bronzes. And so I'm definitely seeing, more demand for, you know, our stuff in its original gold form.
Right. And I'm going to touch upon a slightly more controversial topic. Have you ever experienced plagiarism with your designs or pieces? And how has been your reaction? What has been your reaction to that?
That's why I don't go to the design fairs, because I'm always arguing with some stall owner or the other. Particularly those inlay tables I was telling you about. I mean, they're just copied left, right, and center. But, you know, as a wise lady told me, you know, imitation is the best form of flattery. So I just gulp it and move on. We just try and be more innovative and just try. Also, we've made some of our work very labor intensive. So copying it is more challenging. You know, we've moved on to more complicated, large sculptural installation like furniture pieces, for example. You know, a 12-foot long console or a 10-foot long, tall screen. And these are things very difficult to copy. So, you know, yeah, it's something one just has to live with.
Right. And, you know, you come from a family that celebrates artistic tradition, and you've just conceptualized Shingara Srinathji, a limited edition collector's book, which is, you know, 60 previously unpublished paintings from your late grandfather. Can you tell us more about the book and what made, you know, what provoked you to do this and create this collector's edition?
Yeah, so the book is a very rare collection of 60 miniature paintings showing the different adornments of Lord Srinathji at the Nathdwara temple outside Udaipur. Now, I should mention that most people who are exposed to this form of Nathdwara art relate to pichwais, very large cloth tapestries which hang behind the deity. Those are how we've traditionally seen Nathdwara painting. This book has, the paintings are not pichwais, but they are miniature paintings, about 12 inches by 8 inches. And these were given to my grandfather's great-grandfather, who was he was the Prime Minister of Udaipur and a great patron of the Nathdwara. And this was given in appreciation to him as a patron in gratitude of his, you know, support of the temple complex. So this is a very unusual collection of paintings. And my grandfather always kind of romanticized about the idea of them being published. So just pre-lockdown, I ran into Bipin Shah, Mappin Publishing, and we started talking. And then we produced his book actually during lockdown. And the book's written by Sri Amit Ambalal, who's a noted historian and artist, and has one of the finest collection of pichwai paintings on Srinathji. And so he's kind of written the book and described each of the adornments in this. The paintings were done under the so-called golden period of Nathdwara painting, and as such a very rare collection. So it was a good opportunity to, having met Mappin, to kind of bring them to the public eye.
For you, what is the most compelling aspect of the book?
Okay, so I'd say actually there's not one, but there are three compelling aspects of the book. One is that this book actually catalogues miniature paintings, which have so far not been seen in such a unique collection by the public. Most of the people have seen Srinathji in the form of pichwais, which are large tapestry forms, and not in miniature painting form. So one is that this is a very unique collection of the 60 different adornments of Srinathji during the full year. The second is of the absolutely exquisite quality of the paintings. Each painting is only, less than an A4 size. And yet you see the remarkable craftsmanship. And it was done during the golden period of Nathdwara painting. And third is, I would say, is I'm struck by how contemporary some of these very paintings are. There are some very graphical herringbones and stripes and squares. And what is absolutely astounding are there are about 7 or 8 very minimal paintings, which are called the ghata paintings. They actually reflect, this color of the sky in water on a lake. And they call the ghata paintings. And they're very minimal. So you see them in shades of yellow, gray. There's even a black one. And I'm just struck at how contemporary those are.
The black one actually really caught my eye. I thought it was extremely interesting. I'd never seen a complete pitch black Srinathji before.
So you had them in black, pink, yellow, green, 2 shades of green. And they're quite extraordinary because these were done over 100 years ago and they look like a contemporary artist would do them today, you know.
Right. And, you know, everyone's having conversations about craft and culture. And what aspect do you think deserves the most attention right now?
Okay, so I'd say this is a very good question. And I'd say the number of steps to it. The first is patronage, where you have to identify a craft an artisan or a group of artisans and start the work. And this requires extensive hand-holding. So hand-holding the times of pointing in the right direction of tools. Maybe the tools they were working with have become antiquated. Some element of financing, teaching them about quality, maintaining quality standards. The whole aspect of somehow professionalizing the nature of their work. And this requires a lot of hand-holding. The second is to encourage some innovative design. So you have to try, in order to encourage demand of a particular kind of work, you have to get them out of their box and the kind of work they've been traditionally painting, the traditional motifs they've been painting. So, for example, with international galleries have tried that with Gond art and Worli art, where they encourage them to interpret their traditions in the same language but using different motifs. So it became something interesting for the patron, for the buyer to have in their collection, right? So you've got, the first is patronage of the actual skill in production. The second is encourage design. And the third is to do with marketing. And here, you've got to try and get galleries like they're doing in the West. And design has taken kind of, is moving towards the direction of art, but still hasn't got there yet. But it's moving in that direction. And it's to get the galleries interested in possibly, say, curating a show of different artisans, of different craft clusters, of different crafts, and therefore becoming a platform for people to see what they're all about. And we've done it with Gond art, we've done it Worli art, I know we've done it in brass. So it's certainly possible. It's just a question of creating that dialogue between the artist and the gallery. And here I would add is that one way to do it is to get a designer to work with the artisan. And the other is for the artisan to be the designer himself. So it's just a question of, you know, finding the right artisan, you know, who would fit that bill. Whether someone has the willingness, the exposure to experiment. For example, a lot of the Nathdwara paintings are very comfortable doing the same traditional motifs. And there are few of them only who want to think outside that box. So I think it's a bit of a, you know, sensitive hand-holding where they are encouraged to kind of think out of what they've been doing.
Right. I completely agree with you. I think patronage is very important. But what would you recommend to someone who's looking to support a local craft? Where does one start?
You know, well, there are a number of organizations, non-profit organizations. For example, the Crafts Council of India, which have wonderful chapters in North India and South India, and they have access to various workers. So it also depends on ease of communication and how easily you can access a particular group of artisans. So, you know, there are many places to start with, and once you interact, you'll find them. You have Dastakar, a craft, a venture which is, you know, has its annual exhibitions. They have wonderful people coming and showing there. So, you know, there are platforms to access people and work with them. And you have a number of interior designers and architects now already starting that, you know, for their projects. They're working with artisans and people who work with stone, the people who work with embroidery, textiles. When we first started doing this about 2 decades ago, I found there was a lot of demand for imported goods, furniture and accessories from Italy, and people were going to Europe and coming back with container loads. And over time, I found that there is this interest or desire to have something more individual for the Indians themselves. I think people are more okay about asserting the identity, and it's not just like the crowd bringing in imports, that they're saying, look, we are Indian, we're proud to be Indian, and we want to, you know, we have a tradition of art and craft here, and let's customize things according to our needs. So I am finding there is this big shift amongst kind of the well-traveled, international, exposed clients. And that's kind of translating to, and sometimes it's also coming from the designers and architects, who are themselves pushing this onto the clients. So I'm just saying it's a happy situation that today you're not, that there is this kind of pride in made in India and art and culture.
Right. I think there's a good blend between the two that's forming these days. And I feel like, you know, there's a discerning eye that's coming in as well, where they're realizing the difference between creating something unique with local craft, with local...
You know, what was happening was what I often call the first-class lounge culture, where all those homes, whether they were in, you know, the modern rich homes, all began to look like big, very comfortable lounges. And there was nothing unique. But, you know, what you're seeing that in the Indian art market. There's a lot of demand for quality contemporary art. And I think now that's transcending down to craft and design, that there are, you know, very good home-born designers who, in fact, the irony is that they're selling really well internationally. So, you know, it's when the local demands, you know, now is kind of moving towards appreciating them. So that's encouraging.
And now, what do we see next as VR Home? What are you doing different next? What do we expect from VR Home next?
You know, we are doing a bit more of what we've been doing. We are experimenting with more kind of abstract forms which have an international audience, and we're also delving more into also some of the more traditional materials which we've taken a hiatus from. You know, but now we found that, well, you know, there's a lot of demand locally, and there's still a huge lexicon of unexplored motifs and design elements. So we're doing a bit of both.
And my last question is going to be, you know, you're in the collectible functional art space. What would you recommend to someone, because there are not many people who do it and do it as magnificently as you do it. So what would you recommend to someone who is not able to put their pieces out there, or someone who's starting to do this?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the word collectible, because we have these, I'm going to talk about one particular form of work we do, which is called repoussé. It's what you use as relief material work, which you saw a lot of temples and, you know, temple doors, you know, the embossed kind of work, which is done in brass and silver. And we've been making these large, we've been making our own modern pitchwise. So from, you know, again, the size of traditional pitchwise, 8, 9, 10 feet in length and height. And we've been selling these as limited edition pieces. So no piece is the same. So every piece is different. It requires about 3 to 4 months to make each individual piece. So it's like a form of art. It's like a painting. So in that sense, my advice would be that if you want to get into that collectible world, then you do kind of unique pieces. You make them limited editions. And you try and stretch the envelope, push the envelope in terms of craftsmanship. So when we go up to the repoussé, I'd say, you know, our workshops are probably... You know, given that we spend so much time on it and the kind of skill which goes into it are probably some of the finest in the world. I can't think of any other place which are making these metal sheets which look like, you know, beautifully embroidered fabrics. And it's all made in brass. So we've really kind of pushed ourselves in this particular area. And we've been mostly doing works inspired by traditional art forms such as the pitchwai, tree of life, you know, things of that sort.
Right. No, thank you so much, Vikram. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.